Deutsche Welle, Living Planet.
From DW Studios in Bonn, this is Living Planet, and I'm Charlotte Lomas. Coming up on today's show, saving an apex predator before it's too late, furor in France over frog romance, and why plate tectonics are to thank for songbirds. All that and more coming up here on Living Planet. In Morocco, as elsewhere in the world, bee colonies are dying off in huge numbers. Climate change is killing the plants they feed on and throwing the harmonious relationship between insect and flower out of whack. The Moroccan government is committed to supporting the country's honey industry. Yet the situation for its winged workers is only getting worse as pesticides deal another blow to their colonies. That's why the country's first independent beekeeping association is fighting industrial agriculture and promoting natural, organic honey. Dave Keating presents this report by Dunya Sadaki.
Abdulrani Nakas blows smoke into his beehive as bees swarm up and surround him. Nakas takes a closer look at a dripping honeycomb. He doesn't wear a protective suit, only his head is covered. A banker by day, he says he doesn't even notice the bee stings anymore. For 3 years, his hobby has been beekeeping. Today, he has more than 40 colonies on his property.
I was visiting my neighbors and I tasted some of their honey. I was surprised at the taste and I asked them, "Where did you get it?" And they told me they had a bee colony. And so I asked myself, why don't I make my own honey?
According to the Agriculture Ministry, Morocco's honey industry employs some 36,000 people. An investment program worth more than 130 million euros is expected to further boost honey production, though exactly where these investments will end up has yet to be determined. Morocco's beekeepers should, in theory, be thrilled by the news, but many critics have said the government is putting the focus on quantity, not quality. The problem is that, as in the rest of the world, bee colonies here are also dying off. And Naka says increased investment just won't change that. Nakas opens one of his hives, reaches in and grabs a handful of dead, dried-out bees.
When I inspected my beehives back on March 21st, they were full of bees. A month later, almost half of my beehives were empty. I think Morocco's beekeeping industry is in free fall. It's become worse. This year alone, I lost 50% of my bees.
The reason? Climate change is killing off the bees' food supply. Drought has left Nakas' large sunflower almost completely dried out. And scientists have found that, around the world, bees are missing out on a meal because the changing climate means plants flower earlier in the year. By the time the bee season is in full swing, the best days for nectar are over. And the plants lose out too, if they produce their pollen before the bees make their rounds. Many beekeepers say pesticides used in Morocco's agriculture industry are compounding the threat from climate change. A bee poisoned with pesticides takes the toxic substance back into the hive and brings the whole colony down with it, says Nakas. Along with other beekeepers, he has established AMAN, the country's first organic beekeepers association. They aim to fight the use of pesticides in agriculture, but also promote natural honey production. Bernard Nicolet, an organic beekeeping specialist from France, supports the group.
Moroccan beekeepers are focused on just one thing: honey, 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 honey.
The problem, according to Nicolet, is that they're not addressing the bee die-off. And when the bees die off, that causes much bigger problems. Bees pollinate many crops. Fewer bees to do this vital job means the human food supply could be under threat. Increased investment in the honey industry will not solve the problem, Nicolet believes.
The number of bees in Morocco is not increasing, but the number of beehives is increasing. Where there were once 35,000 to 40,000 bees in a beehive, now beekeepers are satisfied when they have 15,000 to 20,000 bees.
Back at the bee colony, Abdirani Nakas enters the cool shade of his house, takes off his beekeeper's hood, and shows off his stores of the honeycomb. His dark honey has a spicy taste, not too sweet, and he says, with a laugh,
100% natural.
100% natural.
Staying on the continent, we turn to South Africa, to a place called Gans Bay, just a few hours' drive south of Cape Town. This small fishing town is one of the country's top tourist destinations. Miles of white sandy beaches, unique vegetation, and above all, a coastline teeming with marine life draw people from all over the world. But the star of the show is the great white shark, which is found in large numbers in the bay, earning Gans Bay the title as the country's shark capital. But new research suggests that could soon come to an end, as Glynis Crook reports.
A crowd of people gather at Gans Bay jetty, getting ready to board a small boat. They're going off cage diving with great white sharks, the world's largest predatory fish. The boat is one of eight that take hundreds of tourists out to sea every day, bringing in some 100,000 euros per week in revenue to the town, and that's just in ticket sales alone. But a six-year study, published recently by South Africa's Stellenbosch University, suggests that boon could soon end, as the local population of great whites may be heading for extinction. In her office on campus, marine biologist Sara Andriotti says her study suggests there are only between 300 and 500 white sharks left around the coast, of which less than 350 are breeders. These low numbers, combined with their limited genetic diversity, makes them extremely vulnerable.
So genetic diversity is something we look at to understand if a population is healthy or not. And the white shark in South Africa show to share the same sequence of DNA in 89% of the cases. So 89% of the sharks are the same. There is very, very low genetic diversity in the population. And that is really risky in terms of diseases or climate change, because we will have 89% of the population that is going to cope with a change the exact same way. And if they cannot cope with the change, 89% of the population might disappear.
Based on the amount of data collected and the mathematical model applied to their analysis, Andriotti says she's 95% certain of her figures. Shark conservationist and cage dive company owner Mike Rutson has worked in the industry for over 20 years and collaborated with Andriotti on her study.
Through the years, I observed less and less sharks. In the winter in the 90s, it was nothing uncommon to have up to 20 sharks around the boat. My best was 48 sharks in one day, and now you're lucky if you see one to three.
But a group of fellow scientists disagree with Andriotti's conclusions. They say her study is flawed because of its focus on Gans Bay, and are in the process of conducting their own national estimate.
So we have tagged this animal. He was tagged on the 19th of September, I believe.
Great white expert and biologist Alison Cock is one of them. She's also research manager at Cape Town's Shark Spotter program. Cock does, however, agree that great whites are vulnerable and aren't resilient enough to survive if they're targeted by humans.
All of the estimates that have been produced You're talking low thousands. You're talking not tens of thousands of animals. White sharks as an apex predator are naturally low in abundance. So there is always a concern around their populations, particularly if they are being targeted.
Great whites are fully protected in South Africa under several national laws and international agreements, including CITES. But all the scientists agree that the existence of laws doesn't mean these animals are truly protected. Andreotti says the decline in their numbers proves that the measures are not enough. Koch, on the other hand, believes enforcement of the current laws needs to be improved.
In South Africa, it's an ongoing problem because you've got a range of issues when it comes to marine law enforcement, including lack of capacity and lack of funding. So even though they are fully protected, there's only been one case where someone has successfully been prosecuted for illegally killing a white shark. And so I think the level of enforcement and the follow-through can definitely be improved.
The Director of Ocean Conservation Strategies in the Department of Environmental Affairs, Kobani Popose, says the government believes it's doing its best to protect sharks.
Policing is always a very challenging issue. I think with the addition of the Coordinated Enforcement Program, there's been great successes. Our biggest challenge when we're dealing with species such as great white sharks is that these species are highly migratory. We might be focusing in our exclusive economic zone in terms of protecting what we can do in South Africa. But if it's not protected somewhere else, there might be unintended consequences that would counteract what we're doing as a country.
Watch for Mountain Watch, over.
What's that?
Okay, radio check, how do you read me, over?
5 and 5, how do you read?
5 and 5.
The Shark Spotter program in Cape Town. An eco-friendly warning system that protects both the animal and people. All sharks, including the great white, are vulnerable to the impact of humans. They get entangled in nets that protect beaches, are hunted for their jaws and teeth, caught as bycatch, and are losing their habitat and food to pollution and overfishing. Scientists agree that because they are apex predators, a decline in sharks would likely have a negative effect on the entire marine ecosystem. And in Gans Bay, there would be a loss of livelihood if the cage diving industry were to collapse.
I think if the cage diving industry stops in Gans Bay, the town would wither and die. It's the biggest income for the town. In Gans Bay, there is purslane fishing and shark cage diving. So the town is very much based on tourism to get an income from.
Shark in front of you! Don't have you!
Like Rutzen and Koch, Andreotti believes the cage diving industry plays a vital role in conserving the great white.
I think cage diving is, for South Africa, one of the most successful ecotourism stories we can look at. White shark used to be heavily poached and to sell their jaws and their teeth, but since ecotourism activities such as cage diving is happening, a lot of people that used to be fishermen shift into this tourism endeavor, and now people pay to see the white sharks alive.
Responsible tourism, it seems, has been beneficial for the apex predator. But just how much? Only time and more data will tell. Glynis Crook, DW, Cape Town.
Human-animal conflict is one of the biggest threats to wildlife across the globe. Often, the conflict revolves around competing interests for habitat, food, and resources. But sometimes, even human-animal conflicts can seem a little trivial. In France, the final court of appeal is to rule on whether 20 or so frogs, which live in a pond in Dordogne, must have their habitat filled in with rubble because they make so much noise when they mate. The pond owners hope the court will overturn the judgment of a regional appeal court that followed a complaint from their neighbours. The pond owners hope the court will overturn the judgment of a regional appeal court that followed a complaint from their neighbours. Some 100,000 people have signed an online petition in support of the pond owners and their frogs. John Lawrenson reports on a case that is exposing the culture clash that sometimes occurs when people move to the country in search of a quiet life.
It is, of course, not at all mating season at the moment.
There's a little chap looking at me. Won't he make any noise? I don't think he's in the mood for very much, actually.
But in the season of love, as the French call it, this pond that the owners built when they moved here in 2003 sounds something like this. A bailiff came to measure the noise, 63 decibels, as loud as a vacuum cleaner, though more cicadic. French frogs are, of course, used to rough treatment, having their legs pulled off and tossed in the frying pan with butter and garlic, for example, which may be why, if you step down to the pond during mating season, they all suddenly go quiet. But pond owners Michel Pécheras and his wife Annie like their frogs and say putting up with the noisy sex lives of your animal neighbours is just part of the give and take of country living.
À la campagne, on a des bruits de campagne. Et je suis bien à la campagne. Et je supporte les bruits. Il y a des sangliers, là, vous voyez là-bas les traces, qui viennent boire, il y a des chevreuils.
In the country, you get country noises. Here, the wild boar come and drink at the pond. You can see their tracks in the mud there. There are roe deer, too. In summertime, the birds sing very early in the morning. There's noise, but it's nice noise. If you don't like it, stay in the towns.
Et si on les supporte pas, on reste en ville.
It's time to go and see the neighbours. How do they feel about an interview?
No.
They've been having a hard time since that pro-frog Facebook campaign got started with, they say, hate mail and delivery people turning up with stuff they never ordered, unprepaid, of course. Also, they say, a reporter they did agree to speak to didn't represent their views fairly. So, no recording. But they do tell me to pass on their side of the argument, which boils down to this. The Pécheras didn't have the necessary planning permission for their pond. Ponds have to be built at least 50 metres from the nearest habitation. And these frogs are so noisy that in the mating season, they can't sleep. And this is not an isolated case. Out in the French countryside, it's more and more common for people to go to court to get animals to put a sock in it. A few miles up the road, a farmer called Jules Charmois gives some grain to his beef cattle. He's the spokesman for the Dordogne branch of the ecologically minded Peasants Confederation Farmers Union.
C'est pas un musée, la campagne, c'est pas un musée sans bruit, sans odeur, sans rien, c'est quelque chose de vivant, quoi.
The countryside isn't a museum, it's not sanitized. It's a living place with noises and smells where animals live and people work. The cockerel, for example, is France's national symbol, which hasn't stopped people suing their neighbors because their cockerel crows early in the morning. There have been court cases over church bells and cows that neighbors find too smelly. At the moment, we are trying to encourage farmers to start micro-power stations at their farms that use cow dung to produce methane. And almost every time, neighbors or local authorities try to block it.
Back at frog fancier Michel Pécheras's place, he rolls out a copy of the land register that shows there used to be a pond even closer to his neighbour's house than the one he reopened, and another document that states that a pond of these dimensions does not require planning permission. Like so many neighbours' disputes, this is a bitter, drawn-out affair and as complicated as the Middle East.
Inférieur à 1000 mètres carrés. Nous, on fait 400 mètres carrés, même par 350.
Mr. Pécheras accompanies me back to my car, and up in the sky, there's a long, scraggly line of cranes passing over the Dordogne on their migration from the Arctic Circle to North Africa, singing their squeaking, mournful song as they go. The ways of the animals are strange, the ways of the humans too. John Lawrenson, DW, in the Dordogne, France.
Birds evolved alongside dinosaurs, but when our feathered friends first appeared 100 million years ago as true birds, they didn't sing. They might have made some noises, but not much more. Then, 50 million years ago, birds developed vocal organs, and they began to make some really amazing sounds with them. The problem is they were stuck all by themselves on an island for the next 25 million years. Natalie Muller presents this report from Connor Dillon on why we have a geological fluke to thank for bringing bird songs to our own doorstep.
There's nothing like waking up to a blackbird's call. Or a robin's. Or a wren's. There are some of the more than 5,000 songbirds around the world that provide a sort of permanent background musical score to our busy day-to-day lives. Songbirds are passerines, or perching birds. They first evolved 50 million years ago on a big glob of land that would later break apart to form Australia, New Zealand, New Guinea, and even Antarctica. But back then, this big old blob of a landmass was all on its own, an island in the Indian Ocean. And for the next 25 million years or so, songbirds were stuck there, chirping their songs to a very local audience, like the scrub bird. The bowerbird. Or the tree creeper. Then, roughly 25 million years ago, tectonic movements caused a chain of islands to appear between Australia and Asia, in today's Indonesia. That part is certain. New research, however, suggests that through island hopping, songbirds were finally able to reach Asia, and from there, the rest of the world. On far-flung continents, the songbirds kept evolving, like the yellow-breasted bunting of Eurasia. Or the bulbul in Africa and the Middle East. North America gave birth to the wood thrush. And the Caribbean to the Montezuma Oropendala. In South America, the Capuchin bird took flight. And meanwhile, New Zealand, which had broken away from Australia, saw the rise of the tui, which even developed two separate voice boxes. Europe is especially rich in bird songs. It's hard to go a day in Germany, for example, without hearing sparrows. Great tits. Or or swallows. But not all songbirds have beautiful calls, like this magpie. Or even Eurasian jays, whose plumage might look nice, but whose song, well... These birds are the exception, though. Most songbirds produce rich, elaborate and highly diverse sounds, like the song thrush. Or the common starling. In fact, when Europeans first reached Australia, they complained that the birds on this newly discovered continent were not songsters. Their calls were flat and aggressive compared to their far superior European counterparts. But it's fun to imagine how these explorers might have reacted if 25 million years earlier, plate tectonics had not pushed Australia closer to Asia, but instead further away. Then Europeans would have suddenly found themselves at the large, lonely evolutionary epicentre of the bird song, at the only place where birds sang, and they would have marvelled at the thrills, squawks, warbles, shrieks, squeaks, hoots and whistles that awaited them.
Natalie Muller presented that report by Connor Dillon. And that wraps up our animal show for this week. To hear more from Living Planet, download the podcast on iTunes or find DW on SoundCloud. To stay up to date with the latest environment news, visit our website dw.com/environment. Follow us on Twitter at @DW_environment or check out our new Facebook page at DW Environment. I'm Charlotta Lomas. Thanks for tuning in.